Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining me wherever you may be around the world. And it's time for another author interview. I'm pleased to be joined by Grimdark Fantasy author James Lloyd Doolin, author of No Heart for a Thief, Book 1 and the Melee 2 series, and also an entry in the Spiffbow Number 9 contest hosted by Mark Lawrence. James, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, really. It's a pleasure to be on.
Oh, anytime. Why don't we go into a little bit into the competition that you entered. How's it been so far, and what's the overall process and feedback been for No Heart for a Thief?
Yeah, so for those of you who aren't familiar with SPFBO, it's self-published fantasy blog off, and 300 books enter, go into 10 different blogs, and so each blog has 30 books, picks one to send on to the finals, and then all 10 blogs read the last 10 books and pick a winner. It's a little bit nerve-wracking. Depending on the blog you're in, you know more or less about how the blog is going to be reviewing books, what they might be looking for, how many people are going to be reading each book, when they're going to be reading books. I am, for better or for worse, part of a blog that has shared no information about when they're reading their books or which one of them is going to be reading what which set of books first. And so in some ways that's easier because I can just kind of put it off to the back burner. But then when I do think about it, it's a little nerve-wracking because I have no information. It's weird because this is the kind of competition that if you do really well in, people have signed traditional pub deals because of their placing in finalists as a finalist. People have had Kickstarters that, you know, ML Wong just had a Kickstarter that hit, what was it, 230,000. So this could do a lot if I do well. But at the end of the day, it's not the make or break. I'm still going to be writing. I'm still going to be publishing books, regardless of what happens. So I try to put it onto the back burner as much as possible because I'm working on book two at the moment and book three. So book two is in editing phases. Book three is getting that first draft treatment.
Well, awesome. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. An author who I've had on my podcast, Alexander Darwin, he just had his book up for traditional publishing, which is fantastic. And if people take to your book like they took to Combat Codes, I'm sure you'll be getting plenty of notoriety sooner rather than later. I have no doubt about that. Now that I have you on, I actually have a little bit of a history or background question because I don't get too many grimdark authors on to talk about. I feel like everyone's definition of grimdark differs slightly. Your definition probably differs from mine. How would you define grimdark, and what made you want to kind of dip your toe into these waters to write your series?
So that it's an interesting question because I actually wouldn't classify myself as a grimdark author. Certain reviewers have, others have not. I actually had, in the same week, I had two reviews come out back to back. One classified me as YA and one classified me as grimdark. So I was very confused by that. At the end of the day, genre is a marketing thing more than it is a writing thing. I would say that grimdark is best when the violence of the grimdark is serving to communicate something about the nature of violence. So when there's a point to the violence, there's a point to the grimness. The reason I would probably say No Heart for a Thief might not fit a lot of definitions of grimdark is there's a little bit more hope in it. And I think the main characters are less, you know, they make some morally gray decisions, but I think they're following a moral compass. And so it tends not to align with a lot of those grimdark tropes. So I don't know. It's a weird thing. Maybe I am grimdark. I don't know.
Well, I certainly, at least reading some of the fight scenes, especially with Kalo's past, I got that feeling. But maybe it's just me, but that's the vibe I got. And it's all the power to you. I absolutely enjoyed reading it. I want to talk about the cover for mm-hmm. a second, because it's just absolutely gorgeous. For those of you who've read the book or seen a picture of the book, you know what it is. I'm holding it up in front of me, but it's basically, it's Kalo in the woods with a knife in his hand. He's wearing a like a red, I don't know if it's a sash or an outfit. And then there's a big spirit in the background, the mm-hmm. thief, so to speak. Could you just walk us through, was this the picture you had in your mind all along when you wanted the book cover to be drawn? Was after a couple edits? And how is it like working with the artist on this one?
Yeah, Felix Ortiz was great. So I actually tried to get, I tried to work with a different artist first. I was looking for an artist and I didn't know where to start. I was very unfamiliar with self-publishing. I'd done my research, but not enough. And I connected with somebody who ended up just using other people's art to as their portfolio. So they tried to swindle me a little bit. I ended up being able to get my money back, luckily enough. But that was a bad experience. And so I went out looking for the person whose name like came up whenever you heard of an indie pub author going out to getting a great cover done. And so Felix Ortiz is always talked about in that space. He's done some amazing covers from some of the most notable indie authors. So I reached out to him and I described pretty much what's on that cover to him. The main difference would be, in my original thought, the thief had her face revealed. And so we did a couple of renditions like that. But for those of you who haven't read No Heart for a Thief, the thief is a spirit who has a two-toned face, or from the nose up, her face is stark black, and from the nose down, her face is this porcelain white. And it came out looking like a mask, because the description that I wrote really lends itself to looking like a mask, especially without being able to like show really close fine detail. So we kind of played with that back and forth. Then we ended up going for the shadow cloak, which she's often wearing. And I think it just came out with this really nice ominous feel to it. But yeah, I wanted to portray kind of the emotional feeling of Kalo's desperation, yet like yearning for vengeance at the same point. And this kind of feeling of lack of control. And I think that Felix really caught those emotions.
Yeah, he definitely did. And especially with everything that's going on with AI, not just on the writing side, but on the artist side, I feel like it's important to support indie authors and artists wherever they may be. Now that we're on the subject, what's your take on this AI? I don't want to say revolution, because I'm 100% against it, but the emergence of it. What are your two cents?
When I think of AI, I think that it could do so much to lighten the load for so many of us who are employed in fields that have to work with emails and computers and spreadsheets and all that all day. AI could handle a lot of that workload, but that wouldn't necessarily be as profitable as being able to kind of step in and take over the role of the artist and the author. If you haven't seen the intro to the new Marvel Secret Wars, the intro title screen, the title sequence is AI generated. They saved a lot of money by not using artists to do that. Marvel would have to pay so much money to get that done correctly and done well. And it looks AI generated. It looks bad. But eventually, AI art is not going to look bad. It's not going to have the missing fingers, and it's not going to do this weird thing with anatomy that it does sometimes. Eventually, AI books are going to fool the average reader. They may not come up with new nuances and topics and things like that, but they're going to be able to do tropes really well, and they're going to be able to write an average story that's going to serve an average market. But my question is, do we want to live in a world in which the thing that offers so much of us humanity and connection to our humanity, which is art, do we want to live in a world where humans aren't doing that and we're putting more of our efforts back into our work, back into the labor that we produce, and just making people rich off of AI generated content because they're not paying the Writers Guild, they're not paying the actors well enough unless you're A-list, they're not paying the animators or the visual artists very well, because all that money kind of travels up the ladder. And that's just going to be worse with AI.
Yeah, I 100% agree. There can be, I remember with one of the Spiffbow entrants, Bob the Wizard, the whole pushback and the backlash over his quote unquote AI generated cover. It can also have like a profound negative side on the author. In some cases, you might not even know. It's I think it's a huge problem. I mean, it's going to take all of us to get rid of it.
Yeah, I don't know that there's getting rid of it. I think there's regulating it. I know other countries have moved to make sure that any AI-produced content has a label on it, that it's maintained in that way. I know I just saw a Writers Guild post or Authors Guild post on Twitter. They're lobbying Congress to have some restrictions on AI, that it will never be copywritten and things like that. I don't know what's going to happen. What I do know is with Bob the Wizard, I didn't know that was AI generated art. The author didn't. If you're not familiar with art and what to look for in AI generated art, you probably wouldn't know either. And at the end of the day, that author got swindled. He got scammed. And then his name got put out there in a very negative light. So he may have gotten some attention. I hope that goes well for him, but it might not. And so that's worrisome. Like, how are indie authors supposed to verify if their art is any good or if it's AI generated? And how are new artists supposed to come on the market and get any kind of work if nobody can trust them?
That's very, very true. Wow. So sorry to go down that little sidetrack. We're here to talk about No Heart for a Thief. Well, since you've written it, you can do a better job of explaining the some overall plot better than I could. So why don't you tell the audience what it's about and some of the key points, and we'll discuss the characters afterwards.
Of course. So let's just do the quick pitch as is. Kalo is hiding out from the sins of his past when he comes across a young girl who is being accosted by two Imperial soldiers who had just killed her family. And he, against his better judgment, he intervenes. And because of that, he ends up having to face the consequences of his past, the war he started, the war he left behind, and it ends up kind of bringing all of that anguish and things he thought he had left behind and hidden from straight back from where they came. It's a dual timeline story where we learn a lot about Kalo and his backstory as he's telling it to Tayan, the girl he saved. And then in the present timeline, we're learning more about Tayan and Kalo's relationship, as Tayan is, just like Kalo was at a young age, hell-bent on vengeance, and Kalo is trying to teach her a better way.
Great, great intro to it. And why don't we start? Literally the first chapter, you open it up, you see Kalo running through the forest, and he sees Tayan being chased by these two soldiers, Gaucht Empire soldiers. And he decides to save her. And in doing that, he's like the unwilling mentor. He doesn't want to train her because he knows what it's going to take for her to get to where she needs to be to exact vengeance, which is what she wants. And he's 100% against that. And Tayan, on the other hand, she just witnessed her family being slaughtered. She needs to get stronger. She needs to know the skills in order to exact her vengeance. And she doesn't know why Kayla won't train her. So it's a dual-sided story. What was the was there any inspiration for Kalo and Tan as characters before you put them on the page? Do they come from some other work of art that just inspired you to do them? I'm curious.
It's a trope that I love. I love the reluctant mentor. And so I was very interested in pursuing that. But I also really love the story in a story trope. And so kind of merging those two together got me Kalo. Was this reluctant hero who has this really tragic backstory that we're learning little by little. We find out really early on in the book that his name is well known, that he was partially responsible for starting this war to try to take back his home. You know, he has a big past and he's abandoned it all. And so a lot of that came from tropes that I really like. And then really, Tan kind of built out of this. I don't see Tan as a character who's after vengeance. I see her as a really traumatized young child who doesn't know what to do with herself, but thinks the only thing she can do is vengeance. I think she feels like she needs to want vengeance, but she doesn't really. So there's this interesting thing about her where she's just too childlike to understand what vengeance really would mean. But at the same time, it's all that she can think about because she's lost the only people that she's really known her whole life. So I would say they're not necessarily based on other people, but they're based on tropes that I like that I put together and then I tried to refine into something that felt really human.
Great. Awesome. And also with the two main characters, you introduce a very interesting type of magic to the world. Kalo has it. He's able to hear other people's songs. And you introduce it in a very interesting way because one of the main proponents of the thief is the Great Spirit is and people who follow her is that they can steal other people's magic through songs. So can Kalo, but he suppresses it. Can you just go a little bit into that and explain it to people listening? I'm sure they'd love to hear some about that.
Definitely. So just as you said, the thief allows her, the people who are touched by the thief, the people that are her quote-unquote descendants, they're able to steal magic from other people. They're able to, in a sense, borrow because it always reverts back to the original user. And so they're able to take this magic and utilize it for themselves. That really came from this idea. That was actually where this whole story started for me was I love the idea of sin eaters. This idea of some kind of being that can literally eat the sin from somebody, can take it from them and consume it. And I thought, what if somebody could consume magic in the same way? And that kind of played into this idea of, well, the magic is based in this song that certain people can hear and access, and they can pull on it and pull on spiritual powers. But the thief allows people to take that song from others. So I really loved that concept of being able to take that song and take that song away, take that magic away and utilize people's magic against them. And that's where a lot of the story kind of came out of. And I just think it's a really cool concept. But being that, you know, culture builds around a lot of these elements, people have for a long time hated the thief. In fact, the thief is not the name she was given. The balance is the name she was given. And people have decided to call her the thief because of her powers and because of what she represents. And so there's a lot of stories and a lot of things that Kalo has grown up hearing about the thief. So when he discovers that he has a connection to her, it becomes this thing of he doesn't know how to feel about himself anymore, because this thing he's grown up being taught to hate is now a part of him. And so I also thought that was a really interesting thing of how do we define ourselves? Do we define ourselves by the stories we hear and that other people tell about us, or do we define ourselves internally? And at this age, at his young age, especially in the backstory, he does not know how to define himself internally. It's all external. And so when these stories are talking about him now, because he has a link to the thief, he doesn't know how to not hate himself.
Yeah. Kalo is a very, very interesting and complex character. He's been through so much in his past, and he doesn't know exactly, not necessarily doesn't know who he is, but he doesn't know what to make of himself with all these, with the influence of the thief and the him starting the war, and how 18 years later, all that's coming back to him when he saves Taeyeon, and then having to reluctantly train her. But he always says, one of the great quotes of the book, and I don't have it open in front of me, was that I will train you, but I will make you want to stop. I will make you not want to continue. Because he knows what needs to be done and the path that he went down. He doesn't want Taeyeon to go down that path. And it evolves from there. I thought it was great. The plot of the story and how it's broken out with the two timelines, is that the way it was always meant to be? Or did you have it first, you wanted Kalo's past to go to start, and then like an 18-year time jump?
No, I always thought of them as intertwined stories. I think that because what you're seeing in the present is Kalo trying to convince somebody he sees, like a reflection of himself, to not go down his path. And so I think it's very interesting to see how Taeyeon and Kalo's stories mirror each other in some ways and then divert in other ways. And I think there's a third story in there to see that that interaction between those two paths that these characters take. And because it's a trope that I love of stories within stories, it just felt really natural for me to try that on my first attempt, was let's see what I can do with this trope. And, you know, I think it turned out well, because I think in some ways, when you balance out the present and the past, it gives the reader a little bit of breathing room, especially in some of those heavier moments, to jump into another experience and another scene. And it gives you a little bit of distance and a little bit of perspective before jumping back into the past, jumping back into the present.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about your first book. We haven't talked about your origins as a writer. So how did it all start, and what made you want to become a writer yourself?
Oh, I think other people probably have a more interesting origin story than me. But I started out writing poetry. The first time I had access to HBO was in the dorms at the University of Michigan. And I started watching Deaf Poetry Jam, and I got really into it. And I started writing some things, and there was a poetry slam on campus, and I tried my hat at it. And at first I was awful. But there were some things that was much easier to say in poetry and writing out in a creative pursuit than actually talking to somebody about. And so actually the first poem I ever performed was about the loss of two friends who died in car accidents, in separate car accidents. And so it just became this really cathartic thing to do. And then eventually it became something that I really enjoyed, and I started building my skill set in, to the point where I got to compete in the Collegiate National Poetry Slam. I got to compete in the National Poetry Slam as a part of the Baton Rouge Poetry Slam team. I've, you know, been to several different competitions, both individually and as with teams, and performed in a lot of different ways and connected with a lot of different people. And so that was my entree into writing. But I had always preferred reading fiction. I preferred reading literary fiction, and I preferred reading fantasy. And so I always wanted to try my hand at a book. And then I decided my first son was just born, and I decided if I'm not going to do it now, I'm never going to have the time to do it. So I sat down and I started writing, and that was it.
Excellent. What made you want to do the self-publish as opposed to try your hand at like traditional publishing? Mm-hmm. Was it just the ease of entry, or was it something that you, since it's been gaining in popularity over the past 15, 20 years, what was the backstory for that?
I would love to say I was one of those brave souls that saw self-pub as like the future and tried to get in that way. But no, I tried traditional publishing. I tried that route. And for those of you who don't know, querying is when you start, you basically write an application, you write a cover letter, and you send in part of your manuscript to agents, and you try to get them to read your book, and then you try to get them to sign you. Some people write to over 100 agents for one book, and some people like put down several books after failing their queries and going on to the next ones and writing to more agents about the next one. I wrote to about, I think, 30 agents. The first agent I actually heard back from was requested the full manuscript, wanted to read the whole book. And I was like, oh, I've done it. I found my agent. It was easy. But the thing about querying is it takes a long time. You don't hear back from agents for 6 months to a year if they have your full manuscript. Even if you just send a query letter, you may never hear back from them. They may never even say no. So there's a lot of questioning and anxiety and things that go on. And I just got to the point where I started to dislike writing because I disliked the process of querying. And this thing that I loved was really turning sour on me. And so I was like, I'm not going to continue doing this. I believe in the story that I have to tell. And so from there, I just did a lot of research about self-publishing and went on my own. But it was not the foresight, not with a lot of foresight in mind.
Well, it's always interesting to hear authors, how they start out and getting their book out to readers. And you mentioned when you started out with poetry that you always loved reading fiction. Who are some of your favorite authors that you grew up on and read over the years that led you to want to write in fantasy?
Yeah. I think probably the easiest influence to see on No Heart for a Thief is probably Patrick Rothfuss with Name of the Wind. It's a similar story structure. I think the stories are very different. But in terms of a story within a story, somebody telling their story to other people, a person with a mysterious past kind of letting you in on their story, it's a very similar story structure. And I think the thing that I loved about his books was how he could really weave this beautiful prose into a fantastical story. And I was like, I could do something like that. But other than that, I love Robin Hobb. I love N.K. Jameson. Outside of that, Junot Diaz and the Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde in literary fiction is a beautiful book. Elizabeth Acevedo, just an amazing, I also met her as a poet before she came out with her first novel. Her first novel is Poet X, and it's written in verse. It's a YA book written in verse, and it's just gorgeous. And so there are a lot of authors that I kind of connect with, but a lot of poets as well that kind of have influenced me over the years.
And have there been any other self-published authors, maybe some contestants that you're in as well with Spiffo that have got your eye, sort of speak? Which ones have you read and which ones are you enjoying reading?
So I haven't read a whole lot of this year's crop. I'm starting to read. I'm probably about 30% into The Crew by Sadir Samir. And I'm liking that so far. It's so for those of you who don't know, it's a like Deadpool-esque fantasy novel set in a, I guess it would be an Arabic inspired fantasy world. So it's a fun story. It's actually pretty quick. It's only about 300 pages. So it's if you're looking for a decently quick read for fantasy, at least, that's a good one. I really loved A Touch of Light last year from Thiago Adala. And he's been really helpful as just another author as well. If anybody is looking to learn more about self-pub and doesn't know where to go, ask an author who's done it. This community has been so welcoming. I would also say Stones of Light, specifically out of the Threadlight series by Zach Argyle, Stones of Light is an amazing book. And then I think the last book that I've read recently, who's been an SBFBO finalist, has been Legacy of the Brightwash by Crystal Matar.
Excellent, excellent book. I love that one.
Yes, great book. Not short at all. And the sequel is what? Like 400
It's like
pages longer?
something like that, yeah.
But there are some great books out there. I have my eye on quite a few that I'm interested in reading. Seeds of War, Curse of the Fallen. Yeah.
Yeah, Seeds of War, I actually finished that. That's an amazing story as well. Brightwash, I know it's a long one, but the I read I listen to audiobooks all the time, so I just
Gotcha.
flew through that one. Yeah, I've been slowly making my way through those reads, and each one it seems to be like getting better and better and better, and the competition has definitely upped over the years. I was actually a judge on number seven SPIFFO, so I was for the finalist of, was it the Iron Crown? Was that one Hall of Bones? The Brightwash was the one, another one of those. So it's always amazing meeting
Yeah.
different authors and seeing their backgrounds and what is being brought to the table, and it just keeps growing. I can't wait
Yeah.
for it to get back to it. So this has been so great and fun. Why don't you tell the audience members where they can find you, your social media, your website, and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. So you can find me on Twitter is the most active social media platform for myself at James L. Doolin. You can find me there, follow me there. I'm also on TikTok under the same name. I try to post as frequently as possible, but I'm definitely not as great on that. My website is jameseldoolin.com. Pretty simple there. But you can find me on all those platforms. No Heart for a Thief is available on my website with signed copies. I think Silverstone Books has some signed copies as well. If you're interested in supporting an indie bookstore, check them out. And then book two will be on the way this fall. I'm just going through copy edits right now. I've got to say, I think that I'm still very proud of book one, but I think book two definitely surpasses book one in a lot of ways.
Do we have a title for book two?
Oh yes, I'm so bad about that. I always talk about book one and book two. So if you're familiar with No Heart for a Thief, there's a saying in the book that goes, "No heart for a thief, no safe haven, only a grave will do." And those are the three titles. So No Safe Haven will be out in this fall. And Only a Grave Will Do but will be out by the end of 2024.
And is Felix Ortiz doing the cover for all three?
No, it just didn't end up working out with book two. So I have Martin Moyet doing the cover for book two. It's actually done. We're waiting on cover design before a cover reveal. So got to get the letters on there and all that. But it's beautiful.
Great. Can't wait to see it and do that cover reveal to share it with the world. So hear that, everybody? Book two is coming out in the fall. Pick up No Heart for a Thief if you haven't already. It is a fantastic story. A lot of pain, but also a lot of hope as well. You'll be really glad you did. So, James, thank you so much for joining me. Let's do this again sometime.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Cheers, everyone.